This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to this special active ownership edition of LGIM Talks, where we'll be discussing just some of the stewardship activity we undertook as a house for last year, as detailed in our 12th annual active ownership report. A year which saw war in Ukraine, an energy shock, rising inflation, and major volatility in financial markets. So against that background, how did we strive to create sustainable value for our clients? Well, we continued to push for solutions across the depth and breadth of environmental, social and governance issues, whether that was through our extended Climate Impact Pledge programme or the work we undertook with our Global Research and Engagement Groups, or GREGs for short. We held our second Global Sustainability Summit, highlighting how we wove our sustainable actions into investment solutions. We stepped up our action on biodiversity, deforestation, and diversity. And in the built environment, we enhanced our work on the effect of physical climate change on our real estate assets. But before we talk around some of these themes, let's meet today's experts who'll be chatting with me, Frances Watson. They are Michael Marks, Head of Investment Stewardship and Responsible Investment Integration, Amelia Tan, Head of Responsible Investing Strategy for Investments, and Xuan Chan, Head of Responsible Investment and Sustainability in LGIM Real Assets. Welcome to you all. So Michael, if I could start with a basic definition, what is stewardship and how do you approach it?
Well, active ownership is about LGIM as a very large investor, looking after the assets that our clients are invested in and using our investment stewardship capabilities with a purpose of raising market standards and striving for best practice. In order to do so, what that really means is that we're talking to the boards and the executives at companies, being really clear with them about the issues that we believe are vitally important for their long-term sustainable growth and are financially material to those companies. Talking with governments and policymakers and regulators about the frameworks which will enable those companies to make a real-world difference on those topics. It's about us using the tools in our toolbox to influence those companies to make the changes. And that might be just having the conversation, calling out the aspects of their business which they could do something different and change. It could be voting against aspects in their AGM, be it individual directors or specific resolutions. It may be us putting forward a resolution at the AGM asking the board to do something very specific. Or in the case of our Climate Impact Pledge, it might be for those select funds that use the Climate Impact Pledge, determining that we will reduce our capital allocation, we'll divest from companies. But it's not the divestment that matters. It's about the publicity that goes with it, which helps us persuade those companies to engage with us about the key topic of climate change.
Can you give us some examples that are contained in the active ownership report?
Absolutely. So if we look in 2022, we've upped our game on biodiversity and deforestation risks. These are systemic risks that impact climate, that impact the value of long-term value of the companies that we're invested in. So we have looked across the portfolios that we invest on behalf of our clients and assessed the risks those portfolios are exposed to through, for example, commodity-driven deforestation, tearing down forests in tropical areas, and then looked at the companies who are exposed to that activity, either directly through their operations or through their supply chains, such as food companies, and the food where that comes from and where those farms are. And we've been engaging with more than 300 companies on that deforestation risk. asking them about the policies they have, the programs they have to limit their exposure to that risk. And that will lead to potentially voting against those companies in this forthcoming AGM season.
And you mentioned deforestation, and I believe another area of nature where you've also been stepping up activity is biodiversity. And I think you were present at COP15 last year, weren't you?
Well, some of my team absolutely were. And biodiversity, the global biodiversity framework, which came out of COP15, is something that we have been really keen to see delivered. The biodiversity loss that comes along with all of the human activity that we're having an impact on is not just a loss of nature. This is impacting so many other aspects of our economy and therefore the long-term value of the companies we're investing in and potentially the long-term sustainability of us as a human race.
And that's the key, isn't it? When you say about, you know, when investors say, well, why should I do this? And you say, well, actually, longer term, it is impacting value. And talking of investors, Amelia, if I can bring you in, because, you know, Michael has given us some great examples there. How do you implement all the investment stewardship principles at the portfolio level?
Thank you, Frances. You mentioned earlier the Global Research and Engagement Groups, which we affectionately call the GREGs. So I'll start there. The GREGs combine investment and stewardship activities to ensure that we understand the risks and opportunities associated with long-term structural changes in sectors and companies. We incorporate the insights and the engagement outcomes of the collaboration in active strategies, and we have highlighted these in our previous active ownership reports and, of course, the latest one. Now, in this latest edition, we have now also articulated how we put responsible investing into practice in other asset classes and investment styles. In particular, I wanted to highlight our approach in index and multi-asset strategies. If we start with index, I would like to highlight that our stewardship activities cover all of our index strategies. However, we have also taken a step further to directly align our stewardship activities with capital allocation, particularly in our Future World Index strategies through the LGIM ESG score. The LGIM ESG score is made up of metrics across environmental, social, governance, and transparency factors that our stewardship team use to assess and to engage with companies on. The scores are publicly disclosed on our website, so companies know exactly where they stand with us. And importantly, we use the LGIM ESG scores to tilt portfolio weights in our Future World Index strategies in favor of the leaders in ESG and away from the laggards, thereby using capital allocation to amplify our stewardship activities. This is that very concept of engagement with consequence in action. In terms of multi-asset strategies, we need to consider the different types of investment decisions that our portfolio managers take. The key decisions are around strategic asset allocation, tactical asset allocation, the choices of which building blocks we use to implement the asset allocation strategies, and how we pick external managers where we do use them, and of course, their funds. In terms of strategic and tactical asset allocation, our investment frameworks incorporate ESG factors where they are financially material. Now, some asset classes are impacted by ESG factors more than others, and so therefore they feature more in our consideration, for example, in emerging markets. In terms of the building blocks that we use, the value of having extensive responsible investing capabilities across index and active enables us not only to integrate ESG more extensively within our multi-asset strategies, but also to have a more consistent implementation of ESG by having our stewardship and GREGs activities flow through to our multi-asset portfolios via their building blocks. Now, in terms of third-party managers, we also consider how the firm and products that they manage embed ESG considerations as well.
Okay, so you've just highlighted two asset classes there, multi-asset and index. But of course, in the report, I believe there are other asset classes as well, and you go into more detail there. I mean, this is a 136-page report, isn't it? So we are literally just skimming the surface here. But that sounds all very clear for us. Thank you, Amelia. And of course, Xuan, you operate in a slightly different world, the built environment, but still hugely relevant, and even more so because one of they are serial offenders in terms of climate pollution, aren't they, if I can put it like that. And of course, climate risk and flooding is here to stay. So tell us briefly, if you will, how you're tackling it across real estate equity.
Well, as we mentioned in the report, in terms of building greater resilience and climate resilience, in particular flood risk, has very much been identified as one of the biggest physical climate threats to our UK portfolio. And so we have been very focused on undertaking climate scenario analysis on flood risks out to 2030, 2050, and even out to 2100. And we do this by first having an initial high-level assessment of forward-looking flood risk across all assets in our portfolio. And we've been working on this with a climate physical risk specialist called XDI to enhance the granularity of our analysis using what's called unique property reference numbers, or UPRN, another four-letter acronym in the climate world. And UPRNs are essentially the unique identifiers for every addressable location across the UK. And this has really enabled us to analyze the flood risk of our assets much more accurately than just using postcodes. So we have also gathered other granular details such as the building age, the floor height, and any existing flood adaptation measures that have already been done. And so you might ask me, like, what does this mean to an investor? Well, all this building specific information is really useful because it helps us truly understand the baseline level of resiliency and allows us to develop a targeted adaptation strategy for the specific building. And the important thing to note is that when it comes to developing a climate resilience strategy for real asset portfolios in particular, it's really critical to focus on decision-useful information. There's no point getting to a climate score or climate rating if we don't actually know what it means and we don't know how to improve it. And we really see this as just better risk management. A final point I'd like to make, Francis, is that from a stewardship perspective, to Michael's point, is that we continue to engage in industry-wide efforts to drive greater sustainability for the commercial real estate sector. And through my role as co-chair of the Climate Resilience Working Group at the Better Buildings Partnership, we helped to develop a new industry guide last year on climate resilience for the commercial real estate sector, which is very much part of our commitment to achieving net zero.
That's really interesting. Is this groundbreaking work that you're doing, Xuan, you know, with the production of these unique property reference numbers? Is this or is this something that our peers are doing too?
I mean, we had to kind of figure it out and co-develop this with the specialists. So we think it was novel. And hopefully, I mean, we're very open. We hope that others will do the same and use it just so that we have more accuracy and consistency across the marketplace.
If 2022 then was all about climate risk and the impact on assets, it seems like 2023 could be shaping up for a lot of work around your social impact toolkit. Now, I'm not sure how many listeners actually know what a social impact toolkit is, but maybe you'll describe it for us. And again, tell us why it's important for investors to know about it.
I think when people think about social impact, they tend to assume that there is a trade-off between having more social outcomes versus financial returns. Well, investors are now, I think, really waking up to the reality that delivering greater social outcomes does not always come at the expense of risk-adjusted returns. So across our platform, we're really trying to ensure that our real asset investments drive positive outcomes that contribute to local economies and to partnerships that help to improve the lives of communities where we invest, both in the short and in the long term. So, as you say, we've been working on a place-based social impact toolkit for 2023, which can be applied at any stage of the investment's life cycle, that is from the development stage to operations. And this can be adapted across different types of assets, funds, cities, region, or national levels. And this really comprises, to kind of distill it down, comprises a framework covering the core themes, three core themes, which is number one, inclusive economy, number two, health, well-being, and quality of life, and three, climate and nature. And we call it place-based because the needs of a local community will differ depending on where it is geographically located. So what does this mean for investors? Well, there is a proven relationship between economic vitality and real estate investment performance. And we believe that considering social outcomes should be an indispensable aspect of investment activity, much the same way that we do for the environment and climate. That's very much been embedded into our investment process. So we see that an investment portfolio that is driving real-world outcomes is very much essentially a more resilient portfolio and will create better investment value. In the report, we describe an example of of what place-based impact in practice looks like. In Poole, it's a town in Dorset where we own a shopping centre called the Dolphin Centre. And in that asset, we have nurtured a community partnership made up of a group of local stakeholders who represent the needs of the community. Organizations that are tackling issues such as homelessness, aging population, as well as the local university, and of course our occupiers, and including the NHS. And in our partnership with the NHS, we welcome the UK's first diagnostic centre in the shopping centre itself, which really much provides healthcare services in areas such as dermatology, orthopaedics, ophthalmology, and breast cancer screening. And the whole aim of the centre was to create a purpose-built healthcare service place which can be easily accessible in the centre of town. So we now have, you know, statistics to show that over 50% of patients who attend the diagnostic centre actually move on to shop following their appointment. So as a result of delivering better healthcare benefits to the local community, we're also increasing footfall in our retail shops and supporting our occupiers.
So in theory, that's not a shopping centre at all, is it? It's basically a true community hub, I mean, just comprising all sorts of different activities. And that's, I suppose, in its own way, quite revolutionary. So, Michael, just moving on to other sections of the report, and I think when we caught up earlier, you were keen to mention the expansion you've made, particularly in relation to diversity in emerging markets. And up until now, I understand that the focus has really been on developed markets, hasn't it? I mean, just explain to us what you're doing in those markets.
Absolutely. And it's a really nice link to what Xuan has just been talking about, because when we think about social issues, you know, we think from a public market perspective about the diversity of the companies that we invest in, the workforce, the executives, the boards of those companies. And we've for many years been engaging with companies to increase the diversity. And that sounds, oh, that's a good thing to do. It's a good thing to do because with greater diversity comes greater, better decision-making, greater cognitive diversity in those companies. So, as I said, we've been doing this for many years, very much initially focused on gender diversity if we run back more than a decade, and since 2020 on ethnic diversity. But we have had little information and little focus, if it's fair to say, from the investment industry on markets outside of the large, well-known markets. And so last year, we undertook some novel research looking at diversity in a number of strategic and representative emerging markets of Brazil, India, China, and South Africa. And this reaffirmed our hypothesis that the specifics and understanding of diversity varies dramatically across these different markets. And therefore, we will need to take a tailored approach to each of those markets in terms of what our expectations are of companies in those economies. We published our initial findings very recently. And for example, while Brazil is a laggard amongst emerging markets on gender diversity within its corporates, there is a heightened awareness around racial and ethnic diversity and people with disabilities.
So that's very interesting. So different countries, different nuances in terms of the diverse cultures. So, Amelia, I mean, we've talked, albeit briefly, about the environmental aspects of the report. We've touched on the social aspects. I mean, perhaps it seems fitting then that we should start to wrap up with how we approach the G, or the governance, here at LGM. And perhaps you'd end by giving us another example that's been mentioned in the report.
Sure. So we have identified cybersecurity as one of the most critical and fastest growing risks facing companies today, and especially since the COVID pandemic, with digitalization and remote working creating more new opportunities for cyber attacks. We believe that a failure to implement an effective cyber strategy can have significant implications for firms, both financial and reputational. So we decided to develop a better understanding of the issue and how companies across our investment universe are managing their cyber risk. We created a survey that looked to understand whether companies had a strategy to address this, the kind of resources that companies have invested into to manage that risk, and whether the board was structured and competent in dealing with such a technical issue. We also wanted to know whether companies had experienced cyber attacks and the actions they took thereafter to prevent a similar incident from happening. We looked to understand the effectiveness of their cyber insurance cover to mitigate potential financial losses from cyber attacks as well. Now, we approached over 400 companies who were effectively the top 50% of companies across our major indices by weight, alongside priority companies that we identified through our GREGs as well. And we received completed surveys from 22% of those companies, with a further 7% referring us to public disclosures or refusing to complete due to confidentiality reasons. Now, we have since collated the answers into a database, and this will now enable us to identify companies to engage further with on this critical topic.
I mean, it really has been a problem and an ongoing problem, isn't it? All these sophisticated hacking and malware attacks. And obviously, I can see there's an awful lot more work to do there. Well, look, talking of more work, there has been an awful lot of work that has gone into this report. And a heartfelt thanks from me for all of you for contributing, and many others across the business. I mean, obviously, as I said, we've only scratched the surface of what this report contains. As well as the topics we've covered today, you'll find examples of our work on income and equality, executive compensation, and antimicrobial resistance. To read the full report, you can go to www.elgim.com/active-owner. But for now, thank you to today's guests, Amelia, Schwen, and Michael, and thank you to you all for listening.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties, and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website. Copyright 2022. Legal & General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal & General Investment Management Asia Limited, the licensed corporation BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.